This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Characters in a Doris Betts story are most often ordinary people. An overworked mother of three, a burned-out typist, an orphaned mountain girl. In Betts' hands, the lives of these ordinary characters take extraordinary turns. The mother lives with the ghost of a mother-in-law she's never met. The typist steers her car into a river during her morning commute. The orphan sets off on a pilgrimage via Greyhound bus. Her wry humor, strong sense of place, and compassion for those struggling against powerful odds help make Doris Betts one of North Carolina's most revered fiction writers. As part of our series, North Carolina Literary Lights, we're taking a look at the legacy of Doris Betts today. With me in the studio is Eric Woodall. He's directing a production of the musical Violet at Raleigh's Kennedy Theater that opens tomorrow. The play, Violet, is based on Betts' story, The Ugliest Pilgrim. Eric, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Also joining us by phone is Marianne Ginger. She is a professor of English and Comparative Literature at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Good to have you back, Marianne.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be here.
I want to start with you and really let you tell us about Doris Betts' story, The Ugliest Pilgrim. Can you give us a brief sketch?
Of Doris's story? Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful story about a girl who has a birthmark. She's blighted by a birthmark and has suffered during her life because of this. And in a nutshell, she's been rejected and falls in love but doesn't want to recognize that she's in love with someone, and is running from the possibility of this relationship taking her anywhere but towards disappointment. And at the end, she's, without giving too much away, she is overcome by her resistance and is sort of revolts against her own resistance and finds a degree of happiness.
And that resistance, and that resistance is a kind of a character that she's built up, a persona that she's developed in herself, a defense against her own appearance, and that gives her that hallmark quality of the really vivid character that Doris Betts. Tell us about Violet herself, her sense of humor and her grittiness.
Well, she is a typical Betts character in that she's a character of true grit and a character of doubt and a character who's met with a lot of failure, but a character who is like many of the characters in Doris's wonderful book, one of my favorites, Gentle Insurrection. She is in revolt against ordinariness and against unhappiness and against her own meekness, I think. And I think that's what she overcomes at the end.
It's a wonderful story, and anyone who has ever read it, I think, would agree. And then to think that this was turned into a musical, which was a great success off-Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
And we have a little bit of the music from that show. This is Violet when she's first boarding the Greyhound bus on her way to Tulsa.
Move along, Miss.
Mr. Wallace Weatherman, give my scar another nosy look. In a week you'll be surprised. Got my healing planned out in my book. Next week I'll come back disguised. He thinks well of himself, I can tell that. What does he have really?
Here we go, a little bit from the musical Violet, based on Doris Betts' story, The Ugliest Pilgrim. And Marianne, her pilgrimage is to do what?
Her pilgrimage is to, well, essentially enter up in sort of a new awareness of her potential as a young woman with a future that she didn't think possible.
She's on her way to Tulsa. Eric, this play was written in 1997, and it really does deviate from the original story. Tell us in what ways it changes the story.
Well, it starts with the beautiful short story that Doris wrote, and it takes this the nugget, and as great musicals do, starts there and really expands. And there are many direct quotes from Doris's short story. But we find Violet in the mountains of North Carolina with this terrible scar, and she has convinced herself that she can find love and she can find happiness and she can be a different person if she is only healed. So she seeks out on this Wizard of Oz-like journey to meet the wizard, which is an Oral Roberts-esque preacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And she wants to be pretty. And she thinks that that's the secret and that will change her life. And as we've already sort of alluded to, she comes to realize that everything she was really looking for, she had the whole time.
She meets along the way at least two other characters, one of whom is African-American. Race plays an important part in this, mm-hmm. in the story, and in the play as well. How does the play treat the question of race?
Well, it deals with it a great deal because the play takes place in 1964, a few years earlier than the period where Doris set the short story, and it deals – race is a prominent part of it because the African-American soldier really is the one that challenges Violet's belief system and really introduces her to trusting her own heart, finding her own song, letting it sing. And they really begin to form feelings for each other. And that's, as we know, was a very risky thing at that time.
It was. And he shows her that they had a lot more in common. She felt pretty much all alone with this. As an African-American man in the 1960s, he showed her another version of otherness as well.
That's true. And there's a beautiful lyric, one of Jeanine Tesori's lyrics, along with Brian Crawley, that talks about, I just want someone to see me the way that I see you, and looking past a scar, looking past the color of the skin.
And that character is called Flick in both the story and in the play. And we have some more from the off-Broadway production. This is Flick singing to Violet about how he deals with his problem.
Told me, son, forget what might have been. Give yourself a break, whatever's happened.
Go a little bit from the off-Broadway production of Violet. A production will be staged at Raleigh's Kennedy Theater in the Progress Energy Center this weekend, and we have the show's director, Eric Woodall, with us. And Eric, I know you've had a chance to play some of the characters in this play.
Yes, a production several years ago, again in North Carolina, I played the part of the preacher, and which was great fun to be this larger-than-life character and who does, again, without giving too much of the story away, is revealed as the man behind the curtain. So, but that was great, great fun. And it's sometimes difficult in rehearsal to release, you know, my memory of doing it and allowing another actor to find his own voice with that. But our current actor has very successfully done that.
It's one of the things that Doris Betts, I think, did so well was to create these, again, ordinary people in extraordinary situations, and yet never does it descend into caricature. All of her characters have full dimension.
That's so true, and something so important to all of us working on this production, because I don't know when something can be more authentic. Every person in the cast and on the production team, myself included, were either all from or currently living in North Carolina. And it was on day one, I said, we already are authentic. So we have that. And it's so important for us to keep these characters real, because we certainly see in lots of film and television where it's too heightened, and that's not what we're
well at. And musicals themselves, I mean, certainly this amplifies these themes of finding the spirit, the inner self, of shedding the skin and all of that. But that's easy once you get into a musical, again, to kind of overblow that. That's what musicals do. They get big.
That's true. And we've had to really, now that we're in the theater and going through the technical rehearsals, I've had to say exactly that. Now we have to fill the space, and we are doing a musical. So we have to broaden it a little bit. but keep the truth underneath.
Yeah, the Hot Summer Nights now has been kind of noted for its, you know, kind of quick and wonderful productions. Is this is a little bigger thing that this is bigger than what you've
this
been doing?
Is
new direction for you?
That well, it's for Hot Summer Nights. I've known Lauren Kennedy and Alan Campbell for many years and grew up doing theater when we were kids together with Lauren, and I've been watching what they've been doing the last few years with this amazing series. This is the largest production they've ever taken on. We have 15 people on stage, and it's a small black box theater, so intimate. But to hear that many voices on stage is, you know, you can't help but get goosebumps.
Marianne Ginger is someone who has taught Doris Betts' work, and you've seen this production. How the play itself? How faithful is it to the work? And and how does Doris feel about it?
I have to correct you in that I have not seen the production. But I know about the production, and I want to see the production.
Well, come on down.
You can see it this weekend.
Yeah. Well, I'm at the beach. I'm talking to you on vacation. Yeah. But I know that Doris was really pleased, and in listening to what you were saying about the characters and that the cast is all from North Carolina, and there's this authenticity, that this sort of vibe of authenticity, nothing could please Doris more. Because as a teacher of creative writing, that was her big thing to get across to students is that you always start from character, and out of character, a story emerges. It's not the other way around. You don't start with a plot.
We are talking.
I know she's very pleased.
We are talking about Doris Betts today. She is still with us. She's in poor health, and that's why she can't be on the program today. But we have others to talk about her work, including Eric Woodall, the director of the musical Violet at Raleigh's Kennedy Theater in the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts. The musical, based on Betts' story, The Ugliest Pilgrim, runs Wednesday through Saturday, August 28th. For more information about Violet, Hot Summer Nights at Kennedy. .org. That's on the web. HotSummerNights@Kennedy.org. Eric, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Our conversation continues. Marianne Ginger is going to stay with us, is a professor of English and comparative literature at UNC Chapel Hill. Our conversation about Doris Betts continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the literary legacy of Doris Betts. She's a professor emeritus at UNC Chapel Hill, led the creative writing program at the university for years. Joining me by phone to talk about Betts is Marianne Ginger, a professor of English and comparative literature at UNC. And joining me now in the studio is Joe Flora. He is a professor emeritus of English at UNC Chapel Hill. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
Good to be here. Good to have you on the show. Lynn Veach Sadler is with us as well. Lynn is a Sanford-based writer and editor, former president of Johnson State College in Vermont. Lynn, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, it seems impossible to talk about the writing of Doris Betts without comparing her to Flannery O'Connor, and it's certainly a comparison that has been made, Joe. How do Betts' stories resemble Flannery O'Connor's work?
Well, there's a lot of humor in Betts always. It's a different sort of humor, I think. I think her characters are more familiar to us. I think that that O'Connor's characters always have a little edge with them. There's not anyone we're likely to cuddle up with in an O'Connor story. But there are a lot of such that we meet in Betts' stories. And so they're more like people we're going to meet coming around the corner or at the grocery store.
And in terms of religion or spirituality, certainly Flannery O'Connor was confirmed in her Catholicism. Doris Betts much more skeptical or questioning about religion.
She became so, and it's been more a struggle for her. Certainly she was born into something strong, as O'Connor was, but she has that questioning mind about it. And so there was indeed a struggle, I think. But I think the titles of her work and her quest come out. Two of my favorite of all of her works are Souls Raised from the Dead, her novel. They're the titles of Giveaway, and The Sharp Teeth of Love. And the love that interests her is very complex. It's very human love, but it also reaches out to another level of love.
Will you read for us? I know you brought a reading.
Well, I did bring a reading, and it is one that I picked partly because I could hear Doris reading it. And this is from Souls Raised from the Dead, and this was a work that Betts had a hard time finishing because part of her quest in this study of the nature of evil and how could a nice God permit children to suffer and so many bad things happen. And so she has a young protagonist who is going to die at a very young age, and it's from kidney disease. And the character's name is a link, I think, to Flannery O'Connor, and a tip-off. Her name is Mary Grace Thompson. And so Mary Grace is how Betts had a hard time finishing it because when it came to put the girl down, it was just very hard to do it. And this is the scene that came to it. And Mary Grace is in the hospital, and it's rather at the end of things. And this mixes the kind of mystical world with the real world and what that imaginative experience might be like. "I wasn't expecting you," said Mary very softly, surprised she could speak at all. It must have been her turn to talk instead of Miss Lila Torrido's, who only smiled and beckoned with her left hand. She was holding something white in her other hand. "I'm tired of this hospital," said Mary, while Miss Torrido nodded. Even when she sat up in bed, she could not recognize what Miss Torrido was carrying. It looked lumpy. She almost slapped her own abdomen to find out what had cured it since her last medication. Powerful stuff that must have been. There was no pain. And it was easy to breathe. Mary started to push aside the plastic tent, but her hand passed right through, so she dropped both feet off the bed to see if the rest of her could follow. Nothing to it. Miss Torrido backed away toward the door. She seemed entirely healed and normal, although one of her peachy breasts was as inflated as a balloon. She watched Miss Torrido turn to display it, as if showing her best side to a mirror. "What have you got with you?" No answer. The floor was not cold. In fact, her bare feet were not quite touching. "Mary, who did that sound like?" "Grandmother Tacy Thompson." Mary bobbed past her and across the room like a tumbleweed. They were into the long, long hospital hall. Miss Torrido had emptied it out for them. Not a nurse, not a wheelchair. After a while, there were not even any doors. It was wonderful to be able to move the way astronauts did in space. She did not weigh as much as their seed globe of one dandelion. Nor did Miss Torrido, still turned to face her, still drifting backward down the hall. From behind, below, somewhere came the call, "Mary!" And there were loud noises in the room she had left, thumps and talking, a scream, rattles, the bell noises of bottles sliding against one another. But she could not go back just to listen to that. It was a very long corridor with its double doors upon to sunlight at the far end. She almost turned back because Tacy sounded as if somebody were hurting her. But now she could see that Miss Lila Torrido in her white nightgown was carrying a white plate piled high with squares of fudge, white fudge, and waving a white napkin over the candy as she drew them farther and farther down the hall. So Mary laughed and went forward toward that light and that sweetness. And I think you get at the end of there, it's Dante, Milton, It is Cardinal Newman, lead kindly light, and that's the grace of a good death that Betts gives us in that scene. Miss Toredo is also herself a ghost in the bit about the breast. She's had a mastectomy and has recently died, and Mary Grace has had nightmares about the horrible fate of Miss Toredo. But now there's something else here, and this is Grace. This is Grace Betts style, and not,
right. And she had to play the role of God in order to do that. And
she
had to kill off a character in the worst possible way—a youngster who is innocent. And this is her question: how could that happen? And she embodies the role.
She embodies the role.
Right. Wonderful stuff, Lynn. You actually put on a symposium on Doris when you were at Methodist College in Fayetteville. Can you tell us about that?
It was 1989. She said it was comparable to being at her own funeral. It was wonderful. We had all the major figures who write about her and talk about her, friends at Chapel Hill. We had everybody but Billy Graham. Mm.
She is a writer who, Marianne Ginger, let me ask you this question too, but I want to put the question first to Lynn. This notion of the ordinary characters in extraordinary situations, and I think at times it seems that her work borders on or takes us to the threshold of the supernatural. Things are going along so normally. The conversation and dialogue is so vivid. And then you feel as though something magic has happened here or about to happen. Is that something you think characterizes her work, or am I misreading it?
Well, I don't think there are any magical peacocks, per se, but she has an ability to take you from the perfectly ordinary by one seemingly gentle and yet huge move, and suddenly you are transported. And I think she was always looking for what was in the underbelly, particularly of the Southern person, who had this uneducated stance and yet reacted in such an incredible way to words that you were transported by the magic of them. So,
what about that, Marianne? Is there sort of an element of nearly, not the supernatural, but some sense that you're at the border?
Well, when I was listening to Joe read that wonderful passage from Souls Raised from the Dead, I felt myself levitating. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was an amazing passage. I'm so glad he read something from that book, which is one of my favorites too. But there's something in her use of language that I think maybe I would say magical, or the fact that she's using a ghost in this instance to lead this child. And what Joe said is very true. I remember when Doris was writing this book, and I remember everybody was waiting for her to finish it, and it was taking forever, and it was because she could not find a way to write the death scene. Mm. And the fact that she chose this way to do it, which is to make it something almost beautiful, almost seductive in a way. And I find that she uses language to seduce us through some of the worst situations that maybe her characters are enveloped by.
And Joe, there's a story behind the plot of this particular book, is there not? Or is it a story that I'm thinking of that has to do with what she saw in Pittsburgh?
Well, I think this helped get Mary's father. This was the era of, a lot of chicken farming around, and there was an accident on the highway, and Doris had long commutes to Chapel Hill in which she'd dream about all of her characters. And there's this big accident, and suddenly all these chickens are running around the road, and some of them dead, and all sorts of mayhem is going here. And the trooper has to come and try to herd the chickens, as it were, and to clean up this mess. And so this gave her an element, a theme, a trigger for an important character who is there. Also, I love it because one of her important themes is the natural world and what we feel. This is a terrible age to be a chicken. In earlier times in North Carolina, chickens lived on the ground and they walked around and they pecked, and now they're in very different circumstances. These chickens had never been on the earth before. So all sorts of possibilities got opened up by that.
In that event. And Lynn, as part of your symposium you presented on Betts, she talked about her experience as a newspaper reporter, and she had a famous encounter with Robert Ruark. Can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, I'm not supposed to talk about it very much, she said. But I have recently discovered even more than I should know. He was in Spain, living in Spain. She was going to do an article on him. She sent him this long sheet of questions all the way over to Spain.
Journalist from Wilmington, right? So, okay. And a writer. Himself.
Oh, a major writer.
Yeah, and a writer.
But a fellow North Carolinian. Yeah. So they should have been kinder to each other, perhaps. But at any rate, he got angry. And instead of responding directly to her, he sends this very hot column to the Charlotte News, and he called her a bloody loafer and said that anybody who wants someone else to do her work for her should not be in the newspaper business. Well, Charles Kuralt reacted and called Doris and said, you have to respond to this. So she did, and she told them she had two small children, a full-time job. She was freelancing to let her husband go to law school, and she'd published two novels and two books of short stories. So take that and stuff it. The funny thing was, when I was running the centennial for Lee County, I wanted to find out when he had been at the Sanford Herald. So I called Doris to talk to her about it. She did not know he had even been at the Sanford Herald. I had hoped to prove that he was on a baseball team there, called the Sanford Spinners. She didn't even know he'd been.
Hmm. You wrote an essay about Doris. What was the theme of that essay that you wrote?
Well, the one that I would like to share her comments from is actually on the almost spiritual value of something hot, and it's about Southern writers and food. And she sent me this as her take on food, which she called herself absolutely the worst. I loathe cooking, write about food only when good domestic foremothers bring it to reunions, homecomings, and picnics. And here among such women in Pittsburgh, a Presbyterian church, am tolerated with Christian charity as the bringer of napkins, pickles, and potato chips. Me, I saw the drudgery and wanted to be changed to a boy for many years. I do cook, of course, but irritably, resentfully. I'll be one of those senile widows happy on tea and toast, but I'm the telltale gray sheet woman, the gray gravy woman, ostracized by all good cooks. Men dine. They don't have to peel, stir, etc. This was a letter in 93 that she wrote to me.
What are the gray gravy folks? If that doesn't make her a Southern writer, everybody in the audience down here knows exactly what that means.
Right.
Don't be making no gray gravy. Joe, you taught Betts' work in your class. What is it that makes her voice, do you think, so distinct?
Well, that's a toughie in a certain way because I hear her speaking. And I know the actual voice. But there's very quick wit about Betts and things hidden in the line. She certainly repays a rereading of the line because you're going to miss something. And she names her characters in such a way that you know more is going on than you at first get. She names a character Paul. Oh, there's got to be a reason that the character is named Paul, and there is. And Luna has another sort of strange name, and they get together. But her voice is not afraid to take risks and to go widely there in the sharp teeth of love. She's all over America, and I think it is as much or more about America than it is about the South. It is about Southern experience, but it is how the nation is changing as much as the South is changing, and a lot of that she doesn't like. Souls Raised from the Dead, we're really in North Carolina. We're in Carrboro. We're with those folks, and we know those folks. And there are those Chapel Hill people that we know what they are like, and we don't totally trust them, but they're there.
A little too precious sometimes.
A little too precious.
Marianne, you were in school when her collection of short stories, Beasts of the Southern Wild, came out. What was that time like for her?
Well, I knew Doris first as just a wonderful mentor to graduate students. Many of my friends in Chapel Hill were graduate students at the time. I was teaching public school when I first met her before I began teaching at the university. And when that collection came out, she was so revered by the graduate students. She was directing the English composition program. In addition to writing books, she had taken on that mantle. And they adored her, worshipped her. And they were editors of the Carolina Quarterly. The graduate students have traditionally put that magazine out, and Joe will probably remember this. That particular issue had a big pink hippopotamus on it with a heart tattoo, and it was smoking a cigarette in a cigarette holder. It was obvious it was a caricature of Doris, who smoked at the time and used a cigarette holder. And she was not fat, so I don't know why they chose a hippo, but I guess they chose a hippo as homage to Beast of the Southern Wild. Everybody got a kick out of the cover, including Doris.
Well, this was our homage to Doris Betts. We hope she has a speedy recovery. We know she's in ill health now. We wish she could have been on the show, but I want to thank all of you for being here today and sharing your thoughts and reflections. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
My guests are Marianne Ginger, a professor of English and comparative literature at UNC. Joe Flores, a professor emeritus of English at UNC Chapel Hill. Lynn Veach Sadler is a writer, editor, and former president of Johnson State College in Vermont. Coming up next, we meet Duke University's first Hindu chaplain. Stay with us on The State of Things.